So thank you so much to Martin and Sarah for having me today. It's really nice to be here. And as Martin just said, this is from my PhD thesis, so it's very much kind of work in progress. I haven't even been vibed yet, so be gentle. And it's kind of about the production of a population laboratory, which is the term I'm using. But by that I mean a kind of site of long-term demographic study. And as you'll see, it's a particular site for population control experimentation during the 1950s and after. So before I get into the paper proper, I want to just begin by telling you a bit about its context. The paper is extracted from my PhD, which is about the history of population control in India. In the post-war period, many governments, non-government organisations, private foundations and academics became seriously concerned with what they called the problem of overpopulation. The government of India was the first to frame this as national policy. It instituted a national family planning programme in 1952 as part of its first five-year plan. That family planning programme became increasingly coercive throughout the 60s and 70s, culminating in mass sterilizations during the late 70s. Internationally, population control advocates were concerned about population growth across the so-called third world. However, India was really central to overpopulation discourse. So let me just give you a couple of examples of the way in which India is spoken about by overpopulation theorists. It's described variously as the quintessentially overpopulated country or the locus classicus of the Malthusian dilemma. So you get this very clear idea that India is the archetype of overpopulation. Paul Ehrlich, in his alarmist book, The Population Bomb, remarked that India, of course, makes an obvious target. It's somewhere that everyone just knows and understands to be overpopulated. However, many advocates saw India not only as an obvious example of overpopulation, but also as the key to its solution. Beginning in the early 1950s, scientists, social scientists and health experts, largely based in the US in private foundations or academic institutions, placed India at the centre of strategies to address population growth across the third world. India became, in the words of population control critic Donald Warwick, the darling and the downfall of the donors, a prototype to be emulated and an antitype to be shunned. In constructing the Indian people as experimental subjects, proponents of population control hoped to yield solutions not only to the Indian population problem, but to third world population growth in general. One of the key questions of my project, therefore, was why was India so important to international strategies of population control? I addressed these questions by revisiting the Khanna study, which is a well-known population control experiment conducted in the Ludhiana district of Punjab during 1953 to 1960. And if you look at the slide up here, this is my map of Ludhiana in the 1950s. So the Khanna study itself was a collaborative project of the Harvard School of Public Health, the Government of India, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ludhiana Christian Medical College, and the philanthropist Clarence Gamble. Really, everyone was involved at some point. It was among the earliest, largest, and most expensive of all demographic studies in the post-war period. The study was directed by John Gordon, John Wine and Carl Taylor from the Harvard School of Public Health. Between 1953 and 1960, Gordon, Taylor and Wine oversaw field observations from their headquarters in the market town of Khanna, from which the study took its name. They conducted a nine-month exploratory study, a year-long pilot study and a four-year definitive investigation in seven test villages and nine control villages surrounding Khanna. And those villages are what I'll refer to as the Khanna study area throughout. Through these investigations, the study staff aimed to study population dynamics, and the numerous influences that account for variations in population numbers, and to measure the results of an instituted program for birth control. And the birth control program which they instituted was spreading foam tablets in these villages. They're kind of spermicidal foam tablets which dissolve upon insertion. They were not encouraged by the results, however. By the end of the study's staff and funders alike considered it to be a glorious failure, in their words. By 1960, the rate of acceptance of the contraceptive foam tablets was around 15%, which was well below the 25% level of significance which was required in the study design to affect birth rates. Moreover, over the course of the study, field staff realised that some people who had said they were in favour of contraception or had even accepted and taken the foam tablets were not actually using them. Finally, in a follow-up study in 1969, the data revealed that birth rates had declined more in the control population, where the study staff had not provided contraceptive services, than in the test population, where field workers had provided contraceptives. So, since the end of the kind of study field operations, critics have held up the study as a classic example of a failed population control project. The kind of study is nevertheless important for several reasons. For one, the kind of study area became a pilgrimage site for many of the most prominent actors in 1950s population control. As I conducted my research, I was struck by the number of people who visited the small cluster of test villages around Kona during the years of the study. I began to draw up a list. This is part of my list. It's by no means exhaustive, but on this list you can see it's a who's who of 1950s population control. On here we have Rajkumari Amrit Kaur, who's the Minister of Health for India and who was responsible for the establishment of the family planning programme. We've got Chester Bowles, who's the US ambassador to India. We've got, somewhere on there is Dean Rusk, who was president of the Rockefeller Foundation. And really just all the key people involved in the institution of population control during this period made their way around these villages at some point or another, kind of seeing what was going on in the contraceptive study. Right, so, looking at this slide, I argue that the Kona study is important to the history of population control precisely because this string of visitors illustrates the different characters and agendas which converged upon that idea of population control and overpopulation in India during this period. So by looking at these people and their concerns, we can get a very good picture of why population control is important then. However, the Kona study area did not cease to be a site of study and visitation after the initial Kona study ceased in 1960. In 1969, John Wyan, who had worked on the original study, led a study team from the Harvard University Center for Population Studies and the All India Institute of Medical Sciences to restudy the area. So I've done a kind of a timeline showing who comes when. In 1971, Mahmood Mamdani conducted an ethnographic study in the area, which resulted in his neo-Marxist critique, The Myth of Population Control. This was really a classic in the field of population control and was one of the most significant critiques of population control projects during the period. In summary, Mamdani argued that rather than posing a Malthusian threat to families on the breadline, that children were actually an economic necessity for families in this area. The kind of headline was that overpopulation doesn't cause poverty, but poverty causes overpopulation, in summary. We'll come back to Mamdani a bit later, but following Mamdani's visit, during the 1980s, two separate teams came and restudied the area. The first was headed by New York-based anthropologists Moni Nag and Niraj Kuk, and the second by Monica Dasgupta in 1984-1988. Finally, in 2011, I went to the area too, to one particular village to do my own oral history project. So the tradition of this area as a site of study continues. So it's this string of visitors, which you can see on the slide, which forms the starting point for the rest of my talk. This and the idea of Kona as a failure. As I've mentioned already, the Kona study is typically characterised as a failure. It didn't do what it said it should have done. Yet the study had tangible effects on the study villages. I argue, therefore, that the real importance of the Kona study to its villages was not to alter birth rates. Rather, it was to establish Kona, this cluster of villages, as a site of repeated experimentation, or a population laboratory, and as a microcosm for India and the Third World. So that's the kind of background and context in which this talk is situated. So now I want to just take you forward to 2011, to my own oral history project in Kona. What will the role of Manipur be in your thesis? This question was posed to me by Masterji, a retired high school teacher and resident of Manipur, the village in which the definitive phase of the Kona study was conducted. Our conversation formed part of a series of interviews I conducted in Manipur in April and May 2011. I hadn't anticipated the question, and being in the middle of my research, I couldn't really give a good answer. So instead, I explained to Masterji that I didn't exactly know how my thesis would be, but that I felt that the ideas of people in Manipur were really important. Masterji paused for a moment, kind of in the manner of a schoolteacher kind of collecting his thoughts, and then said, "Okay, it's like this. For the people who've written Moni Nag or Mamdani or Kona study, this is a sample for India. The society which is here, that is India's society. The pattern of Manipur, that pattern, about 70% in other states, it can be seen, about family planning." So I asked, "Manipur is a good representation of India?" Masterji answered, "Yes, I think so, because three scholars have studied Manipur. Now you are here." My conversation with Masterji illuminates the status of Manipur as a much-studied place. Since the 1950s, the Kona study area has been cited as the high fertility area par excellence in an influential debate on the rationale for high fertility behaviour in developing countries. Many commentators still take the area to be a standard point of reference in discussions of poverty and population control, particularly in the economic rationality behind fertility behaviour. Yet, by most accounts, the economy and demography of Punjab and Ludhiana, that's the state and the district in which Kona is located, are highly atypical. During the colonial era, Punjab had been a favourite recruiting ground of the British Army. During partition in 1947, Punjab experienced intense upheaval and violence. Importantly, during 1941-51, that's the census decade before the Kona study started, Punjab also had a notably lower birth rate and less population growth than most of India. Government officials attributed this precisely to recruitment of young men to the army and to migration of Muslims to Pakistan. So it's not a typical region to look at all. In addition, before independence, Punjab was a prototype for an improving colonialism, characterised by irrigation projects, agricultural development programmes and cooperative movements. Colonial officials singled out Ludhiana as one of the high population... Colonial officials singled out the Ludhiana district as one of high population density but considerable comfort, thanks to its high agricultural production, large markets and good road and rail links. In short, the Ludhiana district was cited as an example of prosperity and successful development. This trend continued during the post-independence period. By 1970, officials considered the district by far the most important industrial and agricultural centre in the state. Punjab, in turn, was the richest state in India. Punjab also had the highest life expectancy and the lowest death rate in all of India. In addition, by 1989, the use of contraception in Punjab was higher than in any other state. So given all this, all that we know, how do we account for the repeated use of Manipur, this village, and Khanna more generally, as in Masterji's words, a sample for India? Why has this group of villages been the focus of such intensive study and debate? To understand this, I need to take you back a bit to the 1940s and to the Harvard School of Public Health and talk you through step by step how we get from the Harvard School of Public Health to Manipur in 2011 being repeatedly used as a test village. So in the late 1940s, John Gordon, who was Professor of Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health, became, in his words, deeply and sincerely interested in the population problem. Along with his colleagues, Gordon began to introduce this problem into his teaching and discuss ways in which the school might study it. They raised particular concerns about India, where members of the faculty had, they said, perceived the population problem at first hand during their own field studies. The faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health were not alone in their concern about the population problem, nor were they unique in their selection of India as a particular problem area. To understand their concerns, we must locate them in the political, economic, and cultural climate of the time, and particularly the climate in which the post-war discourse about overpopulation consolidated. In particular, we need to understand the dominant demographic theory of the period, that is demographic transition theory, which the demographers in the room will be very familiar with. In the 1940s to 50s, American demographers began to pay particular attention to population growth in the so-called underdeveloped or third world. In the mid-1940s, demographers in the US, led by Princeton's Office of Population Research, focused their work on what they perceived to be the urgent political problem of population growth in the Third World. Such growth, they argued, could lead to resource shortages, economic catastrophe, and political instability. In short, all the conditions believed to breed communism. In 1944 to 45, the leading lights of US demography, Frank Notstein and Kingsley Davis at Princeton, reformulated the theory of demographic transition, which had originally been outlined in the 1920s by Warren Thompson, and they did so in response to this political climate. Demographic transition theory presented both an explanation for the demographic patterns in industrialized societies and a possible model for future patterns in the problematic underdeveloped nations. The classic formulation of transition theory, presented by Notstein and Davis in 1944, suggested that all populations pass through three principal demographic stages. First, societies pass through a traditional pre-industrial stage, characterized by high birth rates balanced by high death rates. So the classic kind of Malthusian scenario. Second, the early phase of industrialization and modernization brought improvements in sanitation, diet, and public health, which brought a decrease in mortality. However, during this second stage, the fall in the death rate was not matched by a fall in the birth rate, and hence you got big population growth. Finally, the combined impact of modernization, urbanization, and industrialization led to a decline in the birth rate. Factors such as enhanced survival, a growing culture of individualism, and rising consumer aspirations motivated people to limit their own fertility, and population growth stabilised. Thus, by encouraging industrialisation, population growth could also be curtailed. So that's the kind of classic theory of demographic transition. However, whilst this classic model held that fertility would fall as a result of the effects of industrialization and modernization, in the late 1940s, demographers altered the theory. And as several historians have argued, in order to provide a more immediate solution to third world population growth, Notstein and his colleagues inverted transition theory to argue that in non-industrialized countries, high fertility itself was impeding economic development. Fertility would therefore need to be controlled in order for economic development to proceed. In a report he co-authored for the Rockefeller Foundation in 1948, Notstein argued that gains in production will be largely consumed by increasing numbers, and that the process of population change will function like the governor of a machine to keep the system in a stable equilibrium of poverty and ill health. The report argued that fertility control would not therefore follow economic development, but was a necessary condition for economic and social changes. So now, population growth has to come first, everything else follows. Like the Princeton demographers, during the late 1940s to early 1950s, the faculty of the Harvard School of Public Health sought ways to adapt their work for use, as they said, in the fight against communism. As part of this effort, the school aimed to build international bridges of health to underdeveloped areas of Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. James Stephen Simmons, Dean of the Harvard School of Public Health, argued that by helping to improve the health of people in these regions, the school could also help to raise productivity and expand food production. Sick men, he said, do not produce effectively. He therefore argued that any realistic attempt to forward the course of democracy in the vast areas which are now threatened by communist aggression should begin with grassroots and rice roots measures aimed at the prevention and eradication of disease. At the same time, John Gordon also began to connect his interest in the population problem with the theory of demographic transition and the new commitment of the Harvard School of Public Health to deploy public health measures in support of Cold War containment. So we have several things happening at once, all coalescing around the idea of population control abroad. In the early 1950s, Gordon took an existing demographic discourse on overpopulation, that is centered around transition theory, and translated it into the language of epidemiology. Working alongside two of his graduate students, Carl Taylor and John Wyon, Gordon developed a new theory which he called the epidemiology of population. The epidemiology of population was a way of viewing population which simultaneously produced Indian people as a target for population study and epidemiologists as experts capable of intervening. And I'll talk you step by step through how we get to that point. In December 1953, Gordon, Taylor and Wyon completed a comprehensive analysis of population dynamics and a project proposal, which they submitted to the Rockefeller Foundation with a request for funding. In this document, the Harvard epidemiologists constructed India as the archetype of overpopulation and the Indian people as suffering from a population problem to which they, public health experts, could provide the solution. They began by defining overpopulation in familiar demographic terms, but kind of scattered with the terminology indicative of the epidemiological approach through which they viewed this problem. For example, they stated that a diagnosis of overpopulation is made in the face of a persistently widening demographic gap between total population and the gross economy necessary to support that population. A progressive fall in the total available calories per person to a low level in the face of an increase in the number of people served as an indicator that a state of overpopulation is present. So this is all about kind of disease diagnosis type language. The fact which marks the situation so serious in India, they argued, is that despite determined efforts, India has thus far been unable to catch up with her food requirements. Whilst they admitted that this definition of an imbalance between food requirements and population would mean that areas of the US, such as parts of the Kentucky Mountains, could also be diagnosed as overpopulated, Gordon, Taylor and Wyon focused on India because they believed that, unlike Kentucky, the local problem in India was set in the context of a larger situation of overpopulation. So basically they're saying that whilst Kentucky and Punjab might be overpopulated, Kentucky is in the US, which as a whole is not overpopulated, but India as a whole is overpopulated. building on the theory of demographic transition, which I just described a minute ago, Gordon, Taylor and Wyon marshalled data and statistics which placed India firmly at the opposite end of the transition process to the US. Pre-transitional nations such as India, they argued, posed the most serious economic and public health problem to the entire world. In their project proposal, they wrote, "Overpopulation is a global problem. Communications, transport, and trade have made the world a unit, a single epidemiological universe. Overpopulation in one region or continent is a concern of all others, as much as pandemic disease. The main difference is timing. A pandemic of influenza spreads and is finished. A pandemic of births is nonetheless real, and the effects last a long time." It's really kind of dramatic language. So the epidemiology of population constructed India as a source of contagion, a nation whose demographic disease posed a substantial threat to the rest of the globe. The solution, which Gordon, Taylor and Wyon proposed, was a public health-style intervention by the West. They wrote, "The point has been reached by countries such as India, where without outside aid, the gap will be closed by the only remaining alternative, a rise in the death rate to meet the birth rate. Within the immediate future, that solution is not likely because the rest of the world will scarcely stand by while that happens." So there's this real kind of sense of urgency in everything that they're writing during this period. Gordon, Taylor and Wyon furthermore argued that since public health had caused the problem through its success in lowering death rates, they therefore had a responsibility to solve it or risk a reversal of their achievements. In particular, they argued that if overpopulation were a disease, which is what they're arguing it is, then it required the tools of epidemiology to address it. In a report he co-authored for the World Health Organization in India in 1953, Gordon stated that the population problem had a strong relationship to the problems associated with communicable diseases. Discussing family planning clinics he'd visited in Madras and Bombay, Gordon described the approach to family planning services thus far as almost entirely clinical. He explained that such measures as are available have been advised and prescribed, usually on a voluntary basis, and in general representing highly select elements of the population, principally women who already have too many children. So he's saying that we're getting there too late, and by focusing on individual women, we're missing the population picture of a whole troubled community. Gordon argued that what was required was a shift from the clinical approach, with its focus on the individual, to an epidemiological approach with a focus on aggregate populations. In short, Gordon argued that what was needed was knowledge of the mass effect instead of the individual result. Therefore, epidemiologic methods could offer a far more productive approach to population control than clinics. After all, he added, no appreciable gain was made in the control of syphilis and tuberculosis as problems of a population until public health action was added to medical care. So he's suggesting that population growth is akin to syphilis and TB, essentially. Gordon had advocated unconventional applications of epidemiology since the Second World War, when he'd turned the tools of his discipline on Trenchfoot. Upon his return to Harvard in 1946, Gordon began to apply epidemiology to a whole range of problems which, like Trenchfoot, had not previously fallen under its ambit. These included nutrition, mental disorder, premature births, and even the epidemiology of accidents. In 1948, Gordon outlined what he called the three principles of medical ecology, that is, host, agent, and environment in relation to tropical diseases. This formula became the prism through which he viewed all other problems. Gordon explained his reasoning as follows. If communicable disease so evidently conforms to biologic laws, if these processes could be interpreted in terms of medical ecology, then other diseases of population groups presumably could be approached in similar fashion. Gradually, it becomes apparent that the epidemiologic method is applicable to most mass diseases of man, and to injuries as well, in the case of accidents, to the extent that they represent problems of population groups. Thus, a range of problems became susceptible to epidemiological analysis and could be understood through the three principles of medical ecology. So, as an example of this, in the epidemiology of accidents, the person who suffered the accident became the host. The faulty pavement and the scalding water became the agent. And the enveloping darkness or rainy weather became the environment. So we get everything kind of translated into an epidemiological language. Turning their disciplinary tools to population, Gordon, Taylor and Wyan began to discuss the idea of an epidemiological approach to hyperfertility. Exactly as they'd done with the epidemiology of accidents, the epidemiology of population applied the three principles of medical ecology to population growth. Gordon, Taylor and Wyan thus approached the problem from the points of view of host, agent and environment. People, pregnancies and births were transformed. The study subject, that is, the man or woman whose motivation to family planning is to be studied, became the host. The method of family planning became the agent, and the cultural, socio-economic circumstances in which people made their decisions became the environment. If it doesn't make sense, it's not my fault. They actually said this. Pregnancy became the modification of a healthy state to which women aged between 15 and 44 were identified as the most susceptible portion of the population and thus primary targets for data collection. So through this epidemiology of population, Gordon, Taylor and Wyan had created a new disease to be treated and cured. They argued that since other health conditions such as TB and syphilis had been controlled through laboratory study followed by field study, overpopulation could be tackled in the same way. Specific answers would be found through the study of specified environments and specified hosts. Without diagnosis, they argued, effort and money spent on population control may well be wasted. To summarise, therefore, what they're arguing for is for public health-style field studies as an appropriate tool to yield solutions to this disease in general, and they had already identified India as the prime example of global overpopulation. Next, Gordon, Taylor and Wyan designed their field study to be conducted in a population representative of India as a whole. The population they selected were the inhabitants of 7 test villages and 9 control villages surrounding Khanna. Wyan later stated that the national census and economic data available to them in 1953 were, quote, sufficient to make the case that population dynamics of rural district Ludhiana reasonably represents other districts in India. So he's suggesting that it is highly representative. Through a field study of Khanna, the Harvard epidemiologists attempted to yield solutions to the population problem in India generally. In turn, they took India to be representative of the third world. One Harvard School of Public Health member, for example, explained that facts had to be gathered at first from a population typical of nations within the problem, yet small enough to enable the investigator to collect relevant data. Thus, Khanna was made to stand not only for India, but for the entire third world. And yet, as I've already explained, the Khanna study area was highly atypical. So much so that during the period of the Khanna study research, the study staff themselves started to comment on this. One member of the study staff suggested that the reason why people didn't want to use family planning methods was because actually they had enough to eat and they didn't see any sense in trying to limit their numbers. She said, The nation's problem is no, the nation's population is no problem in a little village home, especially in the Punjab, where everyone has enough to eat. So we have this kind of bizarre situation in which everyone knows that Punjab is not what they're saying it is. And just pausing on this quote for a minute, as I mentioned earlier, the Khanna study made a diagnosis of overpopulation in the face of widening demographic gap between population, economy, especially food. So, looking at this quote, Punjab was not by their own definition overpopulated. It fails their own criteria to be an overpopulated area. Why then did these Harvard epidemiologists choose Khanna as their study site? The answer is not about demographics, but about accessibility. In particular, it's about the missionary connections of John Wyon and Carl Taylor, who were two of the principal architects. Before studying under John Gordon and at the Harvard School of Public Health in the 50s, both Taylor and Wyon had worked as medical missionaries in India. Taylor had been born there to parents who were working with the American Presbyterian Mission, and Wyon had also been working in North India from the late 1940s to early 1950s, and that's where he'd met Taylor. In January 1953, Taylor took up a post as a head of the newly established Department of Preventive Medicine at the Ludhiana Christian Medical College. It was in preparation for this role that Taylor had gone to train in epidemiology under Gordon in the early 1950s. As part of his work with the CMC, Taylor planned to set up a field practice area for kind of broader epidemiological studies, and as an area in which medical students could gain experience. During the course of Taylor's discussions with Gordon and Wyon at Harvard, the three men simply hitched their ideas for a population study onto Taylor's plans for general public health studies in Ludhiana. Within Taylor's general study district, they just demarcated one group of experimental villages to be used for a population study, so they just hitched it on. They therefore targeted the Ludhiana district as a site of investigation, not because it was representative, but because of the infrastructure of the Ludhiana CMC, which made it logistically convenient. The CMC also provided administrative support offices and helped them secure a mission bungalow, which served as their headquarters. Other advantages were that Khanna was on the Grand Trunk Road, so easy access to Delhi and to Ludhiana, had a railway line and electric supply. So these are really kind of simple logistical reasons why they were there. Lastly, they were able to locate their study there because the government of Punjab and the government of India were both supportive of the study and gave their consent to it. Which again is a whole other paper, but they couldn't have done it if it weren't for the collaboration of the government of India, which they had. So having selected this area as a site of investigation, they then went back and retrospectively diagnosed Khanna as suffering from overpopulation. So in the first annual report of the Khanna study, for example, Gordon listed the main reasons why the study staff had begun their inquiry in that area. He cited in the report the support of the government of India, the infrastructure of the Ludhiana CMC, the work of the government of Punjab, and then lastly, just a final line, almost like an afterthought, he wrote, "The Punjab has a population problem," full stop, no elaboration. Once they'd selected Khanna, they proceeded to construct an apparatus of surveillance around the study villages. And just like they had done in the epidemiology of population, they drew these techniques from communicable disease study, particularly from a study which John Gordon had conducted in Romania in the 1930s on scarlet fever. So again, very much thinking about births as a disease. So, borrowing from James Scott, I argue that Gordon, Taylor and Wyon use these techniques such as mapping, census taking, preparation of forms, in an attempt to make their study population legible and easier to control and manipulate. So these basic procedures of mapping, census taking, were taken from this scarlet fever study which John Gordon had done in 1930s Romania. And kind of in summary, what they did was this. Just like in the scarlet fever study, they began by mapping the location of every building in the study villages and assigning each one with a number. They made a census of all the inhabitants of each home by house-to-house visits and assigned each person a code based on their house number to indicate his relationship with the family. It's a bit complicated, but after that, they prepared a history folder for each home with the members of each family listed in it and their relationship, sex, date of birth, occupation, immunisation status, every bit of information that you can imagine. And then a public health nurse would use this system to visit the homes, every family in the test area at least once a month. And she'd keep a record of her visits on daily worksheets, which she sent to the base office, where staff recorded all data on an individual record sheet for the person in the family folder. So in summary, it's a very kind of comprehensive, intensive surveillance practice centered around family folders, mapping, censuses, all kinds of things that you'd associate with classic communicable disease studies. So the upshot of this was that by the end of the study, the staff had collected an extraordinary amount, really, of information on the inhabitants of Cana. They possessed detailed maps, censuses, information on age, sex, and caste of the village population, a record of live births and deaths, and even kind of where they would locate individual people at different times of day. They even have maps of the fields and lists of who might be in the field at different times of day. It's really incredibly comprehensive. So while the epidemiology of population produced the Indian people as hosts for the disease of overpopulation, the family folder system was the instrument by which that disease was diagnosed and tracked. Importantly, this system of surveillance was also key to the production of Cana as a study site or a laboratory for long-term study. It transformed the area into a study site whose characteristics and behaviours could be subject to statistical manipulation, could be read in the abstract, and compared to other geographical and temporal spaces. So that's the kind of nuts and bolts of it, but to illustrate what I mean by this, I want to just jump forward to a few points in the future and to other people who came back to the area to re-study it. So in 1969, John Wyan, along with Helen Gideon and Roger Revelle, who are also from Harvard, planned to re-study the Cana study villages. They stressed, and this is important, that the study would give a valuable series of points on unusually well-documented population dynamics of a typical part of the rural Punjab. The Rockefeller Foundation similarly stated that there are few, if any, areas in India where so much baseline data material is available, and it should be interesting and valuable to restudy the area and to see what changes have taken place. So they're all viewing Cana now as a suitable area for investigation precisely because it's already been so intensively studied. So Roger Revelle, one of the Harvard guys, elaborated further on how these exact mechanisms through which the Cana study had produced Cana as an accessible site of inquiry. So he talks about existing contacts with local people, village maps, household lists, and how all this will permit what he called a rapid redevelopment of this unique research facility. He goes on to say, you know, exactly how many people they cover with their data and their records of births and deaths and so on. And what struck me about this quote was that because of the systematic surveillance of the first Cana study, the area was no longer simply a cluster of villages near a Christian medical college, but now it's a unique research facility. It's somewhere where they can go back to because they've already been there. Similarly, Monica Dasgupta, who restudied the area in the 1980s, argued that the area was especially interesting to study because the kind of study villages had been so intensively studied before. This meant, in her words, that Kana was in the unusual situation of having a detailed demographic baseline against which to measure subsequent changes over the long gap of years between the 1950s and the 1980s. So it's really, there are a few other kind of population laboratories in South Asia which have similar kind of levels of data over the years. Mutlab in Bangladesh would be one of them, and there are a couple of old Rockefeller Foundation sites which have been studied over and over. But this is one of the key sites. It was important in the 1950s. It was key to studies in the 1980s, and between that, because the Kana study was there, Mamdani went back to do his kind of critical study of the area too. I don't want to get into that too much because it kind of takes us on a whole tangent, but I want to just bring us back briefly to 2011 and to my visit to Kana. So I went along with someone from the Ludhiana CMC who kind of acted as my interpreter, helping hand. We spoke to the Sarpanch, and the first person we interviewed properly was Masterji, who I started with at the beginning of this, the main part of the talk. One of the reasons I went there was because everybody else went there. So I was curious to know, you know, what it means to be in a study village. So to just kind of wrap up before my voice gives way, I want you to leave you with Masterji's answer to me when I asked him, how do you feel about these people studying your village? And this is what he said. I feel very proud. Normally, I say this to people, that there are world-level studies happening about Manipur. And he's right, there are world-level studies happening about Manipur, and there have been since the 1950s. And on that basis, I think we should rethink the kind of dominant discourse about Kana as a failure and see it as really something which was productive in these villages themselves, in establishing them as a population laboratory, albeit for very kind of arbitrary reasons of its logistic location near the Ludhiana CMC, to be places which are studied and restudied every decade someone else comes, to ask something new of these inhabitants. And that's where I'll end, because I think I'm going to give in. Thank you.